Barry, I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
So tonight's the first night of this series of talks I'm going to give on the Four Noble Truths. And of course, I'll start with the First Noble Truth. But before I even do that, I want to just briefly talk about how the Buddha ended up talking about these things in this particular way. And it comes down to, at the very beginning of his journey, his spiritual journey, there was this famous story of what's called the Four Messengers. And the Buddha was Siddhartha Gautama. He was just a prince in this kingdom. And he was brought up in a very wealthy, very protected, very sheltered way, where his father wanted to make sure he never wanted for anything and he never saw anything ugly or anything sad. He was just always going to be in this wonderful place. Had a wife, had a child. And then he got restless, basically. At 29, he got restless later than most of us probably, but he was restless and said, "I want to go out into the world. I want to get outside the grounds." So he'd been living this all this time in the grounds of this palace. And father said, "Well, okay, but you got to go with some guards and captain of the guard." And so off they rode the first time. And as they were riding along, the Buddha saw this old person. He thought, "This must be a person. Looks like a person." But they were sort of stooped over and they were walking with a stick and they were all sort of wrinkled and tilted to one side. And the Buddha turned to the captain of the guard and he said, "What's that?" And the guy said, "Well, that's just an old person. That's what happens when you get old. Your body sort of starts to wear out and things don't work so well. And this is what happens. It happens to everybody. You get old." Buddha was like shocked because he'd never seen, literally, he'd never seen an old person before. Anyhow, next time they ride out, riding along, and there's this person, he thinks, lying beside the road, all covered in sores, and the sores are oozing, and the person's wailing and obviously in pain. And the Buddha says, "What's that?" And the captain of the guard says, "Well, that's someone who's ill. This is what happens. People get, when people get ill. This is what happens when people get sick. It happens to everyone." Now, the Buddha's like really shocked, getting old and getting sick. Oh my God, he's never seen this before either. No, never experienced it. Third time they ride out. And the Buddha's pretty upset already. And they sees these people walking along, and there's four people carrying this pallet on their shoulders, and there's this person lying there, all covered in flowers, and but person wasn't moving and didn't look too good. And the Buddha said to the guard, "What's that?" And the guard said, "Well, that's someone who's died, and they're taking him to the ghat to be burned. This happens to everyone. Everybody dies." And the Buddha just couldn't take this in. He was just at this point, he was just like really pretty much upset all the time. And he was just trying to figure this out. Like, how could this be that everybody gets old and everybody gets sick and everybody dies? He couldn't conceive of it. And it made him really unhappy. He was suffering from this. They ride out the fourth time. And he sees this man in the marketplace and just got this really simple robe and a bowl and a staff. And that seems to be all this guy has. And the Buddha says to the guy, oh, what's that? So that's a sadhu. That's a, you know, a monastic. And the Buddha looks at him and the guy looks really, really happy. I can't figure that out. He stops. Actually, he's off his horse and talks to the monastic. The monastic explains, you know, the rules of monasticism and tells him about this teacher that he could go see. And, you know, Buddha said, this looks great. You look so happy. And he says, well, most of the time I am. Yeah. So anyhow, so those are the four messengers. And so soon thereafter, the Buddha literally ran away from home, much to the objection of his father, and studied with two famous teachers. Then he spent some time in the forest practicing with a group of very aesthetic fellows. And then he finally went out on his own because neither of those solved his problem. His problem was, no matter what he did, he suffered. He was still caught in this space of being unhappy about the human condition, essentially. And then he found the middle way on his own and became enlightened. And after his enlightenment, after he decided to teach, the first time he taught, what he taught was the Four Noble Truths. This was the center, this was the thing he discovered. This is the difference that he had tuned into through his practice. And so this is what he taught everyone else. And the first of these Four Noble Truths is Sarvam Dukkham. And traditionally this is translated as something like the truth of suffering, or all is suffering, or the world is suffering. This is an incomplete translation, and it's very off-putting. In fact, when I first encountered Buddhism in my 20s, and I heard this guy talking about how everything was suffering and how horrible everything was, I walked away, and I didn't tune into Buddhism again until my mid-50s, before I found the Buddhist teachings again. About, well, almost 20 years ago now, I went, oh yeah, this isn't really, it was like, woke me up. It was quite a surprise. I'd practiced in other forms and other traditions before then for a long time. And then, anyhow, I came to this teaching. So the first thing I want to talk about is this word suffering, which is the traditional translation we see, which is, I think, quite off-putting. And it's very incomplete. And I want to do a little bit of analysis of the Pali. So the Pali word is dukkha, right? So, and dukkha is made up of two syllables. Ka, the second syllable, means a wheel. And of course, in the Buddhist time, this would be a solid wooden wheel of a two-wheeled ox cart, that's what wheels were back in the day. And if you ever see, if you go to northern Thailand and Burma and places like that today, you'll see two-wheeled ox carts just like this. Big, heavy wheels. So the beauty of this, of course, is that when the Buddha talked about this, everybody would understand, because everybody knew what a ka was, right? But there's a dukkha. Du means that the hole for the axle on the wheel is drilled off center. So that when you put the axle in the wheel turns very unevenly. So there you are riding around in the cart with a dukkha, and it's like, you just keep getting jerked around, basically. It's like it's never smooth. And this is a better, so it's like basically the world, so when you think of it, sarvam dukham, the world is constantly jerking me around, might be an interesting translation, sort of a more contemporary translation. So other words that I think are much better than suffering for dukkha is unsatisfactory or unreliable. The world is unsatisfactory. The world is unreliable. It doesn't bring happiness. The world in its day-to-day experience doesn't bring permanent happiness. Even this, however, seems pretty harsh. It's like, and it isn't our day-to-day life experience. I mean, day-to-day life experience, yeah, there's some times that are kind of harsh and unpleasant and unsatisfactory, and there's other times that are just great, you know, and that's life. And so it's not that we're denying the beauty of life in any way, and the Buddha wasn't talking about that. Basically, what it means is no matter what you do to be happy, whatever makes us happy now, in the moment, as wonderful as it may be, is impermanent. It's going to change. It's going to go away. And so that means that nothing, because everything is impermanent, nothing is reliable. We can't depend on anything to bring us happiness. There's no way that something will always be there. There's no way that it's always anything will always make us happy. My old teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, used to tell this great story all the time about this is the 70s when I first started hearing this story, 70s. And he talked about Liz and Dick. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who he was very familiar with, right? So we called them Liz and Dick. And of course, you know, now in the here it is 2021, I don't even know what the equivalent of Liz and Dick would be. For a while there, I was using Sean Penn and Madonna back a while ago, but even that's out of date, right? So I don't know who, but there's bound to be some popular couple. You know, maybe Meghan and Harry would be a good example or something like that. You know, just pick a couple. Pick a popular couple. The story goes something like this. Liz and Dick, whoever these people are walking down the street, and they go by a jewelry store. This is in New York. Very fashionable, fancy jewelry store. And Liz looks in the window and she sees this absolutely gorgeous diamond ring. She just, oh, that ring is so beautiful. It would make me so happy. Dick says, yeah, sure, find it. We got to get going. And off they go. Secretly, he goes and gets her the ring. Out to dinner a couple of days later. Between courses, he pulls a little box out of his pocket and puts it on the table. This is for you, dear. And she opens it up and it's like, oh, it's the ring. And she, at that moment, she's totally happy. She's this ring that she couldn't get out of her mind since she saw it a couple of days ago. She'd wanted it all this time. And there it was. And oh, Dick, you're so wonderful. And I thank you. And thank you. Then, so that lasts for about, you know, the first couple of minutes. And then she starts thinking, my God, this is really an expensive ring. You know, we got to make sure we get insurance for it right away. And maybe we should get a fake version of it made I can wear for day to day. And we only get the real one out for special occasions. And she's like starting to worry about it. She's not that initial, but every time she looks at the ring, it's still like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. Then the next day, she finds out the thick's been fooling around. And she looks at that ring and she thinks of Dick and she goes, oh, he's such a horrible person. He's been fooling around. I hate this ring. I absolutely hate this ring because it reminds her of Dick, who's been fooling around, right? Same ring, the ring that 2 days ago gave her total happiness for a couple of minutes. Now, same object, now she's really unhappy. And that's the nature of all things. This is the nature of everything. It's like, if you think about the idea of how getting something makes us happy, in the moment we actually get it, in that moment when she first saw the ring and Dick gave it to her, she was in like total bliss. And it lasted for a couple of days, and then something happened. You know, maybe it wasn't a couple of days, it's a couple of years, still gonna happen. So we're in the state of wanting something that we don't have. That at that point, we're not happy because we want something and we don't have it. Then we actually get the thing, whatever it is. And at that moment, of course, yeah, we're happy. Then at a certain point, further on down the line, whether it's an hour later, a minute later, 50 years later, it's gone, whatever it is. And now we're unhappy again. So as a strategy for getting permanent happiness, getting stuff clearly doesn't work. Because there's the before unhappy, the after unhappy, in the middle, some happy. Doesn't seem to work too well, but we keep believing that that's how we're going to be happy. We keep believing somehow this is what works. Another translation of dukkha is also empty. Just empty. The void of permanence. In the Satipatthana Sutta, this is the Buddha's teachings on meditation, the final instruction in the Satipatthana Sutta starts like this. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. That's it. That's the entire first instruction of this section. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. This is the final instruction on meditation. It goes on. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha, second noble truth. He knows as it really is the cessation of dukkha, third noble truth. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha, which is the fourth noble truth. But tonight, let's just talk about the very first one. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. Well, that's a pretty tall order. He knows as it really is. What does this mean? What's the significance of this statement? Okay, so there's three sort of forms. I mean, usually like the word form, three kinds, three flavors of dukkha that we all experience. And the first one is the dukkha of painful experiences. You know, whether they're emotionally or physically painful, you know, brought on by accident, by old age, by sickness, by death, by our sickness and death, by someone we love's sickness and death. These things are inevitable. There's nothing we can do to avoid all those things in ourselves and in everyone around us. Whether we want to take that in or not, this is a fact. And this is like existential pain. This is existential suffering. This is the truth of life. Whether we like to believe it or not, this is the way things are. The problem is Even if we can sort of believe that this is true, which a lot of people don't, by the way, they go, oh, well, that happens to other people, but not to me. You know, we get caught in that space. There's often this phenomena where people fight against these things. They try, I'm not gonna believe them, or I'm not gonna take them in, or I'm gonna struggle against them. You know, I'm always gonna be youthful and beautiful. You know, there's our culture. Right? And of course they can't. No one can. And this is what in a famous sutta, which I want to read a section of, it's called the second dart. Basically, the first dart is, yeah, I'm getting old. Yeah, I'm sick. Yeah, I just got in this horrible accident. Yeah, this is happening. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. I am going to have an unpleasant time because the first dart just stuck into me. You know, and this is the nature of life. But here's what we do. So this is the Buddha's words here. Bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. The uninstructed noble disciple too feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. There in Bhikkhus, what is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling? That's us. We're the uninstructed worldlings. Venerable Sir, teach us this. And so he goes on. Oops. Bhikkhus, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling is pretty broad, so it could be like an emotional upset, it could be a physical distress, whatever. He sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart. And then they would strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. And the mental one is, oh, poor me, or it's not fair, or why is this happening to me? Or, you know, all those things we go through when we're caught in the midst of some painful feeling. That's the second dart. So the first dart is just life. This is what happens. The second dart is what we add on top. It's like we got one dart already, and then we take a second dart and we sort of stick it into ourselves and then complain that it hurts even more. But that's what we do. That's the first kind of suffering. Okay. And this basically means that your suffering, your dukkha, arises because you are in contention with reality. I came across this phrase a while ago. We're in contention with reality. We're trying to say, no, not me, I'm not, that doesn't happen to me. We're not willing to accept the inevitable. And when we do, here's the interesting thing. When we do accept the inevitable, when we do accept the fact that, sure enough, we're all gonna get sick, we're all gonna get old, we're all gonna die, it brings us closer to everyone else. Because now we have a universal connection to every being, because every being is dealing with, and it's like, oh, I'm connected to everyone through this experience of having a life. Okay, then the second of these is dukkha brought about by change. You know, we lose what we want to keep, and We have to bear with things we don't want or like. Since everything changes, since everything is impermanent, everything goes through this cycle of arising, being there for a while, and then disappearing. We can never succeed in having it so that we only have the stuff we want and we don't have any of the stuff we don't want. But that's what we try and do our entire lives. That's how we keep sticking the second dart in over and over and over and over, because we keep believing somehow that we can get these perfect conditions so that only good stuff and no unpleasant stuff. Once again, we're in contention with reality, because this is not possible. As much as we want it to be, it's not possible. Joseph Goldstein has something to say about this, of course. This is from his book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about something called the five remembrances, which I've talked about before here, but it's good to remember the reminder. And this is, he's actually quoting from a sutta here. Bhikkhus, there are five themes that should be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or one gone forth. What five? One, I'm subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. Two, I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. Three, I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. Four, I must be parted from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. Five, I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever karma, good, bad, or bad, that I do. And then he goes on to say, these five reflections are practiced daily by people who, in many Buddhist traditions, they are reminders of what is true, and they free us from the delusion that we can somehow avoid these aspects of life. It would be helpful to make these reflections part of our own daily practice and see the effect that they have on our lives. So that's that second form of dukkha, that dukkha of brought about by change. And then there's the third form of dukkha. And this is what I've labeled here, for lack of a better term, the dukkha of everyday life. Just everything we have to do to just somehow try and keep it together in the material world. We keep fooling ourselves into believing that everything's okay, often through lack of attention. We see value and value the good stuff and devalue and ignore the unpleasant stuff. This is a lot of the source of a lot of addictive sort of habits. And addictive in the broad sense. When I was younger, much younger, in my 20s, probably late teens, early 20s, I used to think it was a great idea to get really drunk. It was fun. And then I'd pass out. Literally, I'd find myself on a floor someplace the next morning. I mean, really just... But somehow, even though the next day was always often extremely unpleasant, I'd somehow forget. I wouldn't remember the unpleasant stuff. I'd just remember the fun stuff of getting there, of going out and getting wild. Because we forget, we ignore, we don't remember the unpleasant. We devalue it, we disconnect from it, we don't take it in. And then when I finally figured that out, I was around 21 or something, maybe it was 22, I went, oh, I was literally sitting in a bar with a bunch of people in the process, so to speak. And I went, I don't want to do this. And I actually got up and walked out and never got falling down drunk again, ever. It was like a wake up call. And I have no idea why that wake up call occurred, but there was, boing. And it was like, oh, this is kind of a relief. But it was like, my friends thought I was really weird. Like, what happened to you? Where did you go? And I said, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. And it was like, must be something wrong with him, you know? But it was like, that was one of my early wake up calls, that way of acting, that way of sort of heading towards oblivion and thinking it was fun, didn't work. It was unwholesome, unhealthy, whatever you want to call it. Just didn't work at all. Ah, then there's another whole layer of this. And this is interesting. For all three of these forms of dukkha, all these three of these forms of suffering, in general, we often make ourselves suffer even more by blaming ourselves. We think, in fact, we may have been taught that everything happens for a reason, for instance. So if something bad or unpleasant happens, it must be my fault. It's my fault that I got really sick. It's my fault that I broke my leg. It's my fault that that person left me. It's my fault that blah, 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 blah. And this is like the second dart in giant form, you know, because it's not true. Sure, sometimes we do stupid things and cause us ourselves to suffer, but then we add to it by not just accepting the fact that I'm a human being and sometimes I screw up. You know, I should go apologize, I should ask for forgiveness, whatever. There's even, and this is a very sad part of sort of the new age culture that I really am now very down on, though I was very much part of it for a long time. There's this thing that somehow this way of thinking is spiritual. It's like, you know, God intended that this should happen to you so you can learn something. Or it's a punishment and you're suffering and because you're being punished by God for not being good. It's very common. You see this way of thinking all the time. And this is like, so it's either, you know, some supernatural being is punishing you by making you experience this really unpleasant thing. So it's happening for that reason. That's the reason it's happening. Because you did something bad and now you're being punished. Or this is your karma. Yeah, this the new agey version of the same thing, where it's not like some supernatural being. It's just like, you know, you were born, you had this karma, now that's it, you're stuck with it. And it's going to, basically, their karma controls everything. It's like, that's what you've got, you have no control, you have no choice, everything is totally predestined. This is a real serious misunderstanding of karma that is very, unfortunately, very prevalent in the culture. And I want to read something else from the sutta here, where the Buddha talks about this very topic. This is another thing from the Samyutta Nikaya, actually from the same section I read the first thing from. So basically this wanderer came and came to the Buddha and talked to him and asked him, as often was the case, they'd ask him a question. He says, "Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it is pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what is done in the past. That was by their karma. What does Master Gotama say about this? Some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders. And some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders one can know for oneself. And that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what is done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of these ascetics and Brahmins. Some feelings arising here originated from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders, originating from the imbalance of the three." This is Ayurveda talk. "Produced by change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, presumed produced as a result of karma. That some feelings arise here produced as a result of karma, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world." So he's listing all these other things that could be the cause other than karma. Just like, oh, I ate too many burritos and now I have real bad gas. This is an unpleasant thing. It has nothing to do with karma at all. It's just stuff happens. And so this is the Buddha saying, no. You know, there's this whole idea that everything is predestined, that everything is like laid out. And you have to deal with it. And there's nothing you can do to change any of it. It's just a real misunderstanding of the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of the whole of this tradition. Basically, stuff just happens. It's like pretty casual, but it's true. And what's arising is totally out of our control. Some of what happens is the results of karma from previous lives or previous periods of this life, for that matter. If you don't want to deal with past lives, just did something 20 years ago, and there it comes around, and now you got to deal with it. It's the way things are. And we suffer. Dukkha arises when we don't accept what's happening. We don't just say, okay, now this is happening. It's that acceptance that's the key. You know, it's like instead of fighting against it, instead of being in contention with reality, we just accept it and go, oh, yeah, I mean, I don't like this. It's really unpleasant. But that's okay. Then that's where the suffering comes from. And this doesn't, in any sense, and then that one, this is really important, the last sort of thing I want to say, it doesn't in any sense say we should be sort of passive and just whatever happens, oh, well, I'm just going to let it all happen. You know, sometimes we have to actively see, yeah, this is what's happening now. Now, here's something I can do to make this somewhat better. I can't make myself young. But if I'm getting older and I feel my body changing, I can do stuff to sort of make it maybe slow down a little bit and it's changing. Or maybe accept the fact and yeah, now I got to wear sort of better shoes and heavier socks or whatever it is. You know, just, I mean, that's, I'm being simple and ridiculous, but that's the kind of thing we have to do. We have to look at things and go, oh, what can I, how can I work with this? So it isn't just like, I give up. Never, it's never that. It's not that we want to be passive. We just want to see things as they really are. You know, going back to, the Satipatthana Sutta, this, you know, he said, this is dukkha. This is the reality. This is how things are. That's the first noble truth. We have to accept things as they are and see them clearly, that sure enough, some of these things are going to be unpleasant. David Chernikov, who I know quite well, often talks about, in the Tao, they talk about the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. That's life. It's 10,000 of each. I mean, there's lots of both. But it's like we all just want the 10,000 joys and no one wants the 10,000 sorrows. You know, but that's, if we can just approach this from a space of clarity of mind and see things that this is how things really are, then we have a chance of working skillfully with these things that we have no control over. The things that, like impermanence, we can't change. Oh, sorry. I don't want any impermanence in my life. I want everything to be permanent. It's not going to work as much as we want it to. And so that's the first noble truth in a rather large nutshell, shall we say. So I want to do want to finish with this poem. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Thirst. This is a series of poems she wrote fairly soon after her partner of many years passed away. So it has that flavor to it in this whole, the whole book has that sort of flavor. This one's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief. It's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. That's heavy. But that's what we've been talking about. Let's dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.